This audiobook was compiled by Bipolar Bob specially for the Pirate Bay community. You can visit Bob's website at www.bipolarbob.me. High Force. A Detective Chief Inspector Ryan Mystery. By L.J. Ross. Prologue. Tuesday, 29th March. As soon as she awakened, Mackenzie knew that he meant to kill her. There was no confused, fumbling recollection of what had happened. On the contrary, she remembered everything with horrifying clarity. Dark eyes. White smile. A flash of his fist, and then nothing. The car lurched sideways and she was thrown violently against the hard interior of the boot. It was impossible to brace herself against the impact because her wrists and ankles were bound tightly with wire cord. The darkness was heavy and impenetrable, suffocating her. She drew great, shuddering gulps of air into her lungs and felt the warmth of her own breath surround her in the cramped space. Perhaps she could pretend it was all a terrible nightmare and she would open her eyes to find Frank sleeping peacefully beside her. But the scent of diesel invaded her nostrils and the dream evaporated, leaving only blunt reality. Her mind was shockingly awake and would not be fooled. The car wound its way up and over a steep hill. Mackenzie's stomach heaved and she recognized the symptoms of shock. She was shivering uncontrollably whilst also sweating profusely. Her head felt fuzzy and it was as if she were floating above her own body, watching another woman she barely recognized. She sucked air through her teeth, chest tight with anxiety. Her bowels wanted to loosen but she bore down and tried to think clearly. How long had she been here? It was impossible to know for sure whether it was night or day, not a shred of light glimmered to relieve the oppressive blackness of the small space and she had no idea how long she had lain unconscious. But she knew the train had changed. They were no longer traveling on smooth tarmac and the car jerked unsteadily across uneven ground as it trundled towards its unknown destination. She lay there without any idea of the passage of time nor the distance she had traveled and thought of Frank Phillips. I love you, Frank. The car sped through the desolate countryside, away from the men and women who began a frantic search for Detective Inspector Denise Mackenzie. Slow clouds passed across the moon but occasional beams of white light broke through and illuminated the solitary vehicle as it crawled up and down the peaks and troughs of the dales. When the clouds shifted again, night fell like a shroud and was relieved only by the light of the car's headlights as it motored further away from civilization. Now and then, they passed through a hamlet or village but there were no people on the streets and no lights in the windows at that hour. The driver and his passenger continued onward, alone amid a vast expanse of land and water, of ruined farmhouses and the remains of hefted sheep who had wandered too far from home. The whir of the car's engine pierced the silent sky as it rose over the brow of another hill, where it was suspended for a moment before disappearing down into the protective, secretive fold of the valley. Chapter 1. Monday, 4th April. 1 week later. The sleek gray car slowed to a crawl, its tires sloshing through deep puddles at the edge of the road as Detective Chief Inspector Maxwell Finley Ryan peered through the windscreen at a row of unremarkable houses. This can't be the place. He glanced down at the scribbled note he'd made on the back of a dog-eared envelope and then up at the street ahead. Nothing but a dead end, he muttered. The street was tucked away in an area of Newcastle upon Tyne known as Benwell. It was a poor part of town, west of the upmarket city centre and not far from the river. Years ago, A colliery and munitions factory had fueled a booming industry, and rows of uniformed terraced houses had been built for the workers. Now, they stood derelict or run down, some of the red bricks around the doors and windows bearing the evidence of arson. Ryan's ordinary duties as a murder detective took him into the city frequently, but it was easy to forget the old heart of the metropolis. He turned on the windscreen wipers as rain started to fall again. It was barely 8 o'clock in the morning, and the sun was struggling to break through the blanket of thick grey cloud overhead, lending an even more depressing air to proceedings. He was about to turn the car around when he spotted the place he had been looking for. Buddle's boxing gym was little more than a 70s prefab consisting of a square, boxy building with a flat roof, sagging with rainwater. It rested on the foundations of two demolished houses, and nobody had bothered to do away with the remaining concrete which surrounded it like a dystopian moat. It lacked the kind of warm, welcome feel he might have found inside one of the higher-end city gyms, but, since Ryan never bothered to go to any of those, he wasn't in any position to judge. He sat for a long moment, then took a deep breath and slammed out of the car to stride purposefully through the rain. "Howie, man. Is that the best you've got?" Detective Sergeant Frank Phillips wiped the sweat from his brow with a threaded grey towel and threw it back into the corner of the ring. "We've had a good spar, Frank. Let's call it a day." "Aye, if you can't take the pace," Phillips jeered. Irritation won over tiredness, and the other man tapped his gloves together, signaling that he would go another round after all. A boy of 11 or 12 took his cue and banged an old brass bell with the edge of a spoon, and the two men began to dance around the ring. Ryan pushed through the swing doors into the main gymnasium, ignoring the frankly inquiring and suspicious looks from the locals, who huddled in groups to watch the fight that was underway. Testosterone was palpable on the air, and he almost reeled at the smell, a heady combination of male sweat and cigarette smoke. Several pairs of eyes continued to watch him, clocking the striking, raven-haired man who looked vaguely like someone they had seen on the television. He gave them a friendly nod. They didn't return the gesture but turned back to the fight, so Ryan moved further into the room and settled himself against the back wall to watch along with the rest of them. "How's he doing?" The man beside him could have been anywhere between the ages of 50 and 80. His head was completely bald and it shone like a halo around his weather-beaten face. "Which one?" "The shorter one," Ryan said, nodding towards the stockier of the two fighters. "Frank," the man provided. "He's like a man possessed, today. Pummeling the bloody life out of anybody who'll come close. Billy's doing his best, but he'll not last much longer." Ryan said nothing and continued to watch the two men who stood center stage in the old-fashioned boxing ring, illuminated by a row of bare light bulbs hanging from cheap ceiling squares. Both were stripped to the waist and perspiration gleamed against their skin, flickering as they moved in and out of shadows thrown by the patchy light. "Who's the ref?" "Nobody in particular, since Frank floored him an hour ago. He's gone home to his missus, for a bit of tender loving care." Ryan frowned at that, black brows drawing together. "What if things get out of hand?" The man cast him a wary glance. "You're not from the Boxing Association?" Ryan gave a slight shake of his head. Turning away again, the man took out a leather pouch of tobacco and began to roll himself a thin cigarette. "We've had men boxing in here since before you were born. We know how to handle our own. It's you who should watch yourself, else you might spoil your smart clothes." The ghost of a smile passed across Ryan's face. Buddle's was what he might have described as a no-frills establishment, but he admired its lack of pretension. It wasn't the dirt that worried him, it was the apparent absence of safety measures. He folded his arms across his chest and continued his silent observation, wondering why they bothered to wear gloves at all if the object was to inflict as much damage as possible. Frank Phillips was oblivious to the crowd. All he felt was anger, deep and raw, coursing through his body like a torrent. It needed to get out, and this was the best way he knew how. Whack! He took a blow to the midriff and felt the air rush out of his body, but a second later he was back again, coming at the man who had ceased to be Billy from the gym and now represented everything he hated in the world. Smack, left hook. Smack, right hook. Billy stumbled backward against the safety barrier, arms flailing, and Phillips hopped impatiently from one foot to the other before going at it again. Ryan watched his sergeant inflict a series of fast jabs, face contorted into something almost unrecognizable from the cheerful, mild-mannered man he had come to know. Another 30 seconds and Billy fell to the ground, defeated. There was a smattering of half-hearted applause and people began to chatter and disperse. Billy crawled out of the ring on legs that were less than stable, sporting a face that was already beginning to swell. "Howie then, who's next?" Phillips shouted, to nobody in particular. There was a series of rumbles in the negative. "This place has gone downhill since my day," he called out. "If a bunch of lads are too precious to take on an old man like me, what's the matter we are?" His friends looked among themselves and wondered what to do. They'd all heard about what had happened to Frank's girlfriend and they sympathized, but there were limits to how much baiting they would take and the mood was becoming tense. At the back of the room, Ryan came to a decision and pushed away from the wall. "If the offer's still open, I could do with the workout." Phillips squinted at the sea of faces from his elevated position inside the ring and watched a tall figure materialize. When he saw who it was, he shook his head slowly from side to side. "I'm in no mood for games. If you're feeling tired, I'm sure one of these other gentlemen will go a round or two with me," Ryan said, bobbing his head towards the crowd that had gathered once again to see how this fresh drama would play out. He began to shrug out of his navy wool overcoat and thanked one of the teenagers who took it from him. Next, he unbuttoned his shirt. "Don't test me, boy. I won't fight you." Phillip's face was hard as granite, but Ryan could see deep shadows beneath his eyes, the evidence of sleepless nights. Another few minutes and the fight would drain from him entirely, Ryan thought. Keeping a dubious eye on the other man's thick-set physique and murderous expression, he unclasped his watch and entrusted it to a spotty-faced teenager, who palmed it and scuttled away. Shouldn't he be in school? Shrugging philosophically, Ryan dropped his shirt onto a nearby bench and then boosted himself up and under the heavy elasticated barrier of the ring. "Didn't you hear me?" Phillips growled. "I told you I won't fight you. If you're feeling the strain, just say so," Ryan returned. He accepted a pair of gloves and began to pull them on. There was no offer of taping or headgear. "How did you know I'd be here?" "Does it matter?" "It matters to me." Ryan lifted one bare, muscled shoulder. "I asked around. You had no business coming to find me," Phillips ground out. "If I'd wanted you to know where I was, I'd have told you. In case you've forgotten, I'm still your superior officer, Ryan said flatly, although the words stuck in his throat. You can't expect to go ill for 2 days and have nobody come looking for you. You have responsibilities, to the department, to yourself, and to Denise. Don't you dare bring her into this. With that, Phillips lunged forward and planted a gloved fist squarely into Ryan's face. The force of it snapped his head backward and sent him careening into the barrier behind. There was a collective gasp from the crowd. In the silence that followed, Ryan shook himself off and accepted a towel to dab at the trickle of blood which ran from his nose. A quick wriggle told him it wasn't broken, at least. He didn't like to think what Anna would have to say about that. Phillips swallowed and began to apologize. Sorry, lad, I... But Ryan waved it away. I think that was the bell for round one, wouldn't you say? With that, he landed a hard blow to Phillips' stomach. If you think that I'm going to go easy on you. Phillips fought back and Ryan had a fleeting moment to regret his earlier decision before raising his gloves to block a series of blows. He parried, circling the ring to tire them both out, but Phillips had energy to spare. You don't need to do me any favors, boy, he said, feigning a left before planting his right glove into Ryan's chest. Ryan doubled over, winded. You're stubborn as an old mule, he panted. Phillips cupped a hand to his ear. What's that? You've had enough of a beating for today? Ryan looked up, slowly. Hard of hearing, as well, he concluded, before surprising Frank with a sharp jab to his midriff, followed swiftly by a solid crack to his jaw. Phillips landed hard on his ass and looked up in shock. Where the hell did you learn to box? Boarding school, Ryan puffed. And the Rocky franchise? Phillips' lips trembled. Have you had enough? Ryan asked, eyeing the red marks he'd inflicted with a small stab of conscience. Phillips looked around at the faces in the crowd, let out a long sigh and then pushed himself back to his feet. I've had enough. Ryan unstrapped a glove and held out a hand. Phillips did the same and, swearing roundly, pulled him in for a hard hug. I needed that, he said roughly. Any time, any place, Ryan said dryly. They pulled apart and faced each other again. I don't know what to do, Phillips said simply. I can't stand to think of Denise, of whether she's still alive, somewhere out there. Ryan could imagine, only too well. Her abductor was an infamous serial killer called Ear Edwards, a former medical doctor better known in the press as the Hacker. Less than a week ago, Ryan and his team had been dealing with the fallout from another murder case. While their backs were turned, Edwards had escaped from his maximum security prison in Durham and kidnapped Detective Inspector Denise McKenzie from her own home. Every man and woman in Northumbria Sid knew the violence Edwards was capable of inflicting, but none more so than Ryan himself, who had brought the man to justice and lost his sister in the process. The memory of it still haunted him. Now, he looked into the bleak eyes of his sergeant. Neither of them knew what had happened to Denise, and history was not on her side. Ryan understood the feeling of failure that had driven Phillips back here to the people who knew him from the old days. He remembered the driving need to fight back, to expel the hate and the anger that grew stronger every day that he was without the woman he loved. But now it was time for Detective Sergeant Phillips to get back to work. Don't think about the what ifs, Ryan said. Think about how to find her. How? Phillips burst out. Nearly a week has passed and we've got nothing. No leads, no sightings. What if he's killed her already? Ryan mustered a confidence he didn't entirely feel. We have to believe that Mackenzie isn't his main objective. Edwards will make contact and tell us his demands. He must know that we're watching the airports and the ferry ports. He has limited means and his face has been splashed all over the regional and national news. There's a nationwide manhunt underway. He can't hope to escape without trying to use Denise as leverage. What if he doesn't want to escape? Frank said. Ryan's mouth flattened. There was always the possibility that Edwards had an entirely different motive in mind, one that didn't require him to keep live hostages. If he wants a crack at me because I'm the man who put him away, he'll have his wish just as soon as we find him. He raised a hand to give Phillips' shoulder a reassuring squeeze. But I need you on board, Frank. I need you with us, helping us. Phillips blinked a couple of times and looked away. I let her down. I should have been with her. You haven't let anybody down, Ryan said forcefully. There was no way you could have known. Now, for God's sake, put your shirt on and come back to work. I don't know how much longer I can stand here looking at your belly. Philip's chin jutted out in a manner reminiscent of his former self. There's a layer of pure muscle beneath this belly. I'll take your word for it. Chapter 2. The atmosphere was hushed when Ryan and Phillips walked into the Northumbria Criminal Investigation Department on the leafy, western border between Newcastle and the county of Northumberland. They stood inside its scuffed double doors and breathed deeply of the homely smell, a potent mix of pine cleaning detergent and casserole that wafted its way upstairs from the direction of the canteen. Ryan was relieved to see a healthy number of staff in attendance, although the room was nowhere near the hive of activity it had been when news had first broken of Edward's escape and Mackenzie's disappearance. Durham Sid were leading the investigation into how Edwards managed to engineer an escape from HMP Frankland, while Northumbria Sid focused their efforts on tracing the whereabouts of their colleague and her abductor. Tyne and Wear Constabulary and several other neighbouring constabularies had offered their time and resources. Despite it, they were now entering the seventh day of a joint investigation that showed no sign of light at the end of the tunnel. Detective Inspector Denise Mackenzie was a popular woman and a good murder detective with a solid history of public service. Her kidnap had elicited an outcry from a local and national media, who rallied around to ensure that ordinary people could not fail to recognize her abductor's face as they went about their daily lives. But inevitably, as time passed, the news bulletins began to refer to her in the past tense, betraying an assumption that the worst had already happened. They discussed her life and profession as they would a fallen soldier, sacrificed in the line of duty. Newscasters began to speak of institutional failings and budget cuts to explain how a notorious killer had escaped his pen, and opinion was divided on whether the police were doing enough to find her. Was there a lack of resources or were they merely incompetent? Chat shows reopened the hackneyed debate on capital punishment, stoking a fire that already burned in the hearts of the men and women of the Northeast. It was inconceivable to think of a man such as Edwards roaming free again, able to hunt new victims and devastate other families. The idea of putting down such a dangerous animal was tempting, and Ryan couldn't deny that the prospect held a certain lure. But that would make him no better than a killer. Underneath all the scaremongering was a generous dose of good, old-fashioned fear. It was the kind that kept people awake at night and led them to imagine that their neighbor was a homicidal maniac. They rang the incident room to report a killer living next door, one who looks exactly like that escaped convict everybody's been talking about and, oh, would they mind sending a couple of policemen around to arrest him? Time wasters, everyone. Ryan looked around the tired faces of his team. Despite what the papers said, he knew they had worked tirelessly for 6 days. Their loyalty was commendable, but he had not been able to prevent their gradual reallocation to other casework. After all, serious crime had not stopped in the wake of Sid's own tragedy. All right, listen up. Conversation was suspended as detectives and support staff noted the arrival of the two newcomers. Poor old Frank, Phillips imagined them saying. His button brown eyes darted from one display board to the next, images of Denise blurring with those of Ear Edwards in blown up Technicolor. One of the constables hastily moved to stand in front of one board, but it was too late. He had already seen the lurid photographs of Edwards' previous victims. He remembered each of their faces, anyway. He had seen their mangled bodies lying on an impersonal metal gurney at the mortuary, and he had mourned every one of them. Now, the same man was at large again, and this time he had Denise. Denise. Phillips took a long, shaky breath and dragged his eyes away from the board to look at an enormous map of the Northeast. It was dotted with pins to denote areas of interest while a bank of photocopiers and printers hummed along another wall. A single telephone began to ring plaintively across the room, in painful contrast to the incessant ringing of several telephones only a few days ago. The trail was going cold and people were beginning to lose interest. Just then, a hand came to rest solidly on his shoulder. He whipped around and saw a young man wearing an earnest expression on his clean-shaven face. "Good to have you back," he said, and practically threw himself into Phillips' arms. "There, lad." Phillips gave him a manly pat on the back as his face was crushed against the shiny fabric of Detective Constable Jack Lowerson's suit jacket. The overpowering scent of some flashy aftershave filled his nostrils, damn near choking him. Ryan grinned and took the opportunity to address the room at large, making sure his voice carried into all four corners. "As some of you may know, D.S. Phillips has been out of the office on a short period of special leave," Ryan lied smoothly. "He has now returned and is eager to get on with the business of policing, which is what we all do best. Let's keep the idle chatter to a minimum and welcome him back." There followed a short, spontaneous round of applause, and Phillips felt a lump rise in his throat. Thanks for all the cards and messages," he managed. I know Denise would appreciate it." Ryan waited a beat and then clapped his hands together. "All right, get back to work." The summons came exactly 20 minutes later. Ryan and Phillips retraced their steps along a wide, utilitarian corridor and up an equally minimalist stairwell towards the chief constable's office. In other circumstances, they might have made a pit stop at the ancient vending machine for a cup of bad coffee, but not today. Ryan's footsteps slowed as they approached the door with its tarnished brass plaque. "You ready?" Phillips patted the collar of his shirt in an automatic gesture and was dismayed to find his necktie hanging in a loose knot. He took a moment to adjust it, smoothing down the fabric. "Ready." Ryan decided to keep his opinion of Phillips' apparel to himself. He had chosen a tie of bright emerald, embroidered with a series of tiny dancing leprechauns. At any other time, it would have been ridiculous, But he imagined Phillips had acquired it on one of his visits to Ireland with Denise, and so he held his tongue. He rapped a knuckle against the chief constable's door. Come. When they entered, Chief Constable Sandra Morrison had a telephone handset wedged between shoulder and ear as she flipped through a large file of paperwork with one hand and scribbled notes on a dog-eared notepad with the other. Her sandy blonde hair had been tamed into a tortoise-shell hair clip at the back of her head, but it was starting to come loose amid the stress of the morning. She paused to raise her index finger, indicating that she would be another minute. Taking advantage of the brief lull, Ryan made a beeline for the coffee machine in the corner of the room. He happened to know it served a far better standard of caffeine than the machine downstairs. I think another press conference would be premature. Yes, of course, I understand your position. Morrison dropped her pen and began to knead an ache developing at the back of her neck. Ryan and Phillips edged towards the visitors' chairs arranged in front of her desk and settled themselves. I can assure you that we are pursuing every possible avenue, sir. He's as good as vanished into thin air. Phillips took a small, scalding sip of coffee and felt his stomach quiver. Yes, sir. I'll have an update ready for you by the end of the day. The air thrummed with leftover tension from Morrison's conversation for a full 10 seconds after she ended the call. In the residual silence, they could hear the everyday sound of traffic from the main road below, reminding them that ordinary life continued beyond the walls of Sid. Morrison allowed herself a moment to collect her thoughts and used that time to study both detectives. There, on the one hand, was Phillips. A reliable man, one she had worked with for nearly 30 years and whom she would venture to call a friend. Like a bloodhound, he followed the scent of a case until its conclusion through a combination of common sense and raw intelligence. He was often brash and straight-talking to say the least, but he was also scrupulously honest, which was a quality she admired and encouraged among her staff. Studying his face, she saw clear signs of strain. His skin bore an unhealthy grey pallor and bruises were beginning to bloom on his face and jawline. Framed against the bright light filtering through her office window, she was saddened to note that he looked at least 10 years older than he had a week ago. Then, there was Ryan. The media's darling, most of the time. Despite being several years younger, he was senior to Phillips in rank and, at one time, she had wondered how they would get along. She needn't have concerned herself because the two men were more like family these days. But where Phillips was what she might call a people person, Ryan was a strategist, a born leader capable of viewing an investigation with the precision and detachment of a field marshal, with no compunctions whatsoever about giving offense if it reaped results. He had the capacity for great things and his track record proved it, but he followed instinct as much as he did rules and regulations. That meant she could never entirely trust him to follow orders, but his heart was in the right place. She knew that his family owned an old pile of bricks somewhere down in Devon, and yet he had chosen to leave those soft, rolling hills for wilder, untamed northern shores. He had chosen hard work over an easy life and, looking at him now, she thought that he had made a wise decision. Being a healthy, red-blooded woman, she might as well admit that he wasn't hard to look at, either. Even with a swollen nose and the beginnings of a black eye. Well, she said briskly, gesturing to their coffee cups. I see you've already made yourselves quite comfortable. Phillips set down his cup with a bit of a clatter, while Ryan took his time finishing the last couple of mouthfuls. Thank you, ma'am. Morrison rested her elbows against the scarred beach desktop and linked her fingers. In case you're interested, that was the commissioner on the phone, she said. As if the enormity of our task isn't enough, his media liaison had a tip-off about our senior investigating officer brawling with another senior detective this very morning. She flicked a glance towards Philip's bruised face. One with a remarkably similar description to you, Frank. Philip squirmed in his seat. I can explain that, Ryan interjected. Given the turn of events and the fact Edwards is considered armed and dangerous, I felt it would be wise to brush up on my self-defense skills, in the event they're needed. Phillips kindly offered to share some basic boxing skills with me this morning at a fully licensed boxing gym. Ryan had a strong inkling that Buddles hadn't been on the official radar for years, but he wasn't about to mention that. Morrison fixed Phillips with a direct stare. Is that what happened? Phillips cleared his throat. Yes, ma'am. Just like the man said. I kept the moves basic, since he's such a novice, he smiled winningly. Morrison looked between the pair of them and knew when she was beaten. Look, she said wearily. I don't know what happened, or why, but let that be an end to it. Phillips, I hear you've been out of the office for the last 2 days on a period of leave. I don't recall you mentioning this to me, Ryan, but given the circumstances I think it was best all round. Morrison licked her lips and wondered how best to approach the next question. The fact is, nearly a week has passed. Nobody will be more aware of that fact than you, Frank, she said carefully, but questions are now being asked. We're accountable for our management of the situation. What are you saying? Ryan sliced through the waffle. Morrison sighed. I'm saying that the commissioner has doubts about whether the officers investigating Mackenzie's disappearance can remain objective, given the clear conflict of interest. This isn't just a matter of being unbiased. It's about making sure that we are seen to be unbiased in the public eye. If you're insinuating that Phillips. I'm referring to both of you, Morrison interrupted the beginnings of an angry tirade. Ryan, your relationship with Ear Edwards is already a matter of public record. The man killed your sister and nearly killed you. Nobody could blame you for wanting to be part of the task force that will eventually see him return to a maximum security prison. But, if anything were to go wrong, well, you can imagine the backlash. Ryan said nothing but his eyes darkened to a turbulent gray, the same shade as the North Sea. As for you, she shifted slightly to face Phillips. Your relationship with Denise Mackenzie is an open secret around these parts. To all intents and purposes, you're her next of kin. That being the case, how on earth do you think yourself capable of following the avenues of this investigation with the level of detachment that we need? Philip's face fell into aggrieved lines and she was sorry for it but forced herself to continue. Believe me, Frank, I feel for you. Everyone in this department is feeling the impact and we all want to help. I know that you want to be an active participant because I would feel the same way myself. That's why I gave you this past week to end things quickly. But as your commanding officer, I can't allow it to continue. Ryan broke the uncomfortable silence that followed. Let me see if I understand you correctly. The commissioner is beginning to feel the heat from the powers that be. They're fielding accusations from the press about police incompetence and they're looking to shake things up, so they can appear to be on top of things. Correct? Morrison inclined her head. That's hardly breaking new ground, is it? I haven't worked on a single major investigation where the papers haven't taken a pop at our methods at one stage or another. Have you, Phillips? Can't say that I have, came the reply. It's a thankless job. Exactly. We don't do this work for the plaudits, and we're not interested in playing at politics so that we can be popular with the tabloid press, Ryan said, scathingly. We're interested in justice, whatever the hell that means. He leaned forward and Morrison felt the full force of his anger transmitting itself across the expanse of her desk. So, with all due respect, ma'am, don't sit there in your ivory tower and talk to us about detachment or conflicts of interest. Because whether it's my sister, his girlfriend, he jerked a thumb in Philip's direction, or a total stranger, once we've agreed to take care of them, they matter to us. Every one of them matters. You're too close, Morrison tried again. Every time we get a call from control, we have to be objective. We put on the mask of indifference and set aside that creeping feeling that tells us, just maybe, this one won't be coming home. We visit the mothers, the fathers, the sisters, the brothers, and we shatter their lives. We tried to ignore the terrible instinct warning us that there will be more lives ruined before all is said and done. So, if you want Mackenzie found, if you want Edwards back behind bars, then you won't do any better than Phillips or me. Because not only do we do this job every day, we know Mackenzie and we know him. We know how they both tick and we're invested. We can bring this home for you, we just need more time. Ryan fell silent and sank back into the foamy chair. I see, Morrison linked her hands again and turned to his colleague. Do you have anything to add? Phillips was no public speaker, but he set his jaw and sat up a bit straighter in his chair. I won't beg, he said forthrightly. I won't grovel for a place on the team. I've earned the right to be there. Edwards has vanished into thin air, you said. I say that's bollocks. He's not a ghost, he's flesh and blood and he's out there, somewhere, with the woman I love. I'll tell you this, Sandra, he didn't bother with formalities since they had cheerfully sailed over the line of insubordination long ago. I was born here and I've spent my life getting to know this land. I'll turn over every rock. I'll look behind every tree and search every building and outhouse from John O'Groats to Land's End if I have to. But I'm going to find Niamh Mackenzie with or without the support of the bigwigs at Northumbria Cid. Do you know what else? He jerked his head over his shoulder. There's a room full of people down on the second floor who'll help me do it. Every last one of them has a personal connection with Denise as a colleague and as a friend, so good luck finding anyone unbiased in this building. Morrison drained the last of her coffee. Good. That's all I needed to know. She gave them a small nod. Taking their cue for dismissal, both men exchanged a look and rose hastily to their feet. They had almost made it to the door when she called out. Ryan? He turned back and raised an eyebrow. Don't let me down. A muscle ticked in his jaw, but professionalism won out, as it always did. The door clicked shut behind them and Morrison sat staring at it for a long time afterward, wondering if she had just made the biggest mistake of her career. Chapter 3. Water sluiced over Mackenzie's bare skin in a miserable, icy cold trickle. She stood facing the wall, focusing her vision and her mind on the dated bathroom tiles. Cream with a pattern of faded brown flowers, and she'd counted 47 of them in total. The bathroom suite was bottle green and equally old. The cheap plastic tub was cracked and mold grew in the corners. Every other surface was covered in a layer of dust and insect decay. Turn around. She fought back tears of humiliation. Stay calm. Survival is key. She wasn't ashamed of her body, and her mind was far, far away, somewhere he could not touch. Slowly, she turned from the wall and fixed her eyes on a point above his head. She had learned that it was possible to remain in control if she could avoid looking directly into his eyes. Somebody had once said that the eyes were the windows to the soul, but what did they say of a man without a soul? When she looked into Ear Edward's eyes, she saw nothing but dark emptiness, a fathomless chasm where his soul should have been. The man himself lounged against the wall and took a leisurely survey of his prisoner. You know, Ruth, you're really not bad. Not bad at all, he said, with the tone of one making a great concession. Not my type, regrettably. Relief must have shone in her eyes because he added, I could always make an exception. It would certainly pass the time, wouldn't it? He smiled, enjoying the fear and confusion racing across her face. The arms she had thrown around herself to protect her naked body tightened, fingernails digging small arcs into her own skin. Would you like that, Ruth? I seem to remember you sending me several very flattering letters while I was incarcerated. Perhaps you'd like a demonstration, now that you have the real thing? He spread his arms and caught his own reflection in the spotted mirror above the pedestal. Like a true narcissist, he took a moment to admire himself, flexing his considerable muscle and watching it ripple beneath the woolen jumper he wore. She wanted to scream, to shout, to lash out. But she'd tried all three and had earned herself a smattering of injuries in return. Her left ankle was sprained and she suspected that at least one of her ribs was fractured. Dark purple bruises covered her torso and kidneys. My name is Denise, she whispered, then instantly clamped her lips shut again. She speaks, Edwards exclaimed, clapping his hands together in delight. There was no fun to be had while she retreated behind her silent armor. He stepped closer and was gratified to see her shudder and cringe away from him. He ran an idle finger along her leg, feeling the goose pimples against her frozen skin. In prison, you told me your name was Ruth. Don't tell me that was a lie. His voice was mild, as if remonstrating with a small child. Tut tut, he continued, tracing a fingertip around her belly button. I don't like liars. Mackenzie clenched her jaw so tightly it cracked. She understood that he was punishing her. A year ago, she had worked undercover, assuming the persona of Ruth to elicit information from him about another case. She had worn a wig and played the part of a sad, lonely woman obsessed with a charismatic serial killer. She had flattered and cajoled him, gone through the motions of being infatuated by him. In short, she had played him for a fool. Somehow, he had found out her real identity, and it must have made him even angrier to find that she was part of Ryan's team, the man responsible for putting him behind bars. She wondered how long Edwards had planned his revenge, this campaign of psychological torture, or whether he improvised as he went along. It didn't really matter. She continued to stare at the wall and eventually, he sighed. I have to go out soon, Ruth. I hope you'll manage without me. Mackenzie's heart quickened, beating like a bird in her chest. He was leaving her alone. Here you go. Solicitous all of a sudden, he handed her a moth-eaten towel. She snatched it from him and quickly wrapped it around her skin. Then, he held out a hand to help her step out of the bathtub. She imagined herself slapping it away, clawing at his face, his eyes, crushing his skull against the porcelain sink. But her body was so broken and stiff with pain, she could barely move. She stared at his hand and thought about the violence it was capable of inflicting, then took it and struggled over the edge of the tub. She winced as the movement jogged her ribs and sent shards of pain narrowing through her chest. "Thank you," she mumbled. It did no good to provoke him, she thought. So long as she was courteous and polite, agreeable and conformist, she stayed alive. At least for now. Immediately after getting the green light from their chief constable, Ryan called a briefing. It was held in the largest conference room at SID, designated as a major incident room to investigate what had affectionately been named Operation Ireland. Within the space of half an hour, it was brimming with staff ranging from admin support to trainee detectives and data analysts, all of whom had set aside their other work and foregone their lunch in a display of solidarity. Ryan had taken a moment to rearrange the board, which was the entire length of one wall, to redirect their attention to the facts in their possession. He knew there were computer programs that could do it all for him, but he was of the old school and believed that there was no substitute for the visual impact of seeing Mackenzie's image front and center, reminding them why they were all there. As the clock struck 12, Ryan strode to the front of the room and shoved his hands in his pockets, sweeping a glance around the sea of faces. He watched Tom Faulkner, the senior CSI, hurry through the doors with a gaggle of CSIs in tow while Phillips took his seat in the front row next to Lewison, who clucked around him like a mother hen. He opened his mouth to quieten the chattering din but, for once, the room fell silent of its own accord. "It's been a week," Ryan said without preamble. "And, before we go any further, I want to thank all of you. Nobody could have asked for a more loyal or hard-working team. The sad fact is, despite our efforts, we still haven't found our friend." He didn't give them time to mourn before moving swiftly on. "Current thinking is that we've missed something, somewhere. So, we're going to do the only logical thing and go back over our tracks. That includes reopening every one of Edward's old case files." It was a tall order to retrace every report, every sighting and every piece of forensic evidence generated over the last 7 days in addition to every year Edwards was an active killer, but it was the only way forward. "I don't need to tell you that we've ground to a halt." He met Phillips' stare and didn't flinch. "Until Edwards shows himself, we're treading water. But experience tells me there has to be a trail, one that we're not seeing. I propose we start again and, this time, we find it." There were murmurs of agreement, nods of heads. "As you know, Durham police have been leading the investigation into Edwards' escape." He moved across to a large board with a list of action points and pinned photographs. "To recap, at approximately 11:30 on the evening of last Monday, 28 March, a Sikorsky S-92 helicopter belonging to the search and rescue base at Humberside Airport landed in the central courtyard at HMP Frankland, in Durham. It was able to land thanks to a lack of wire netting to protect the overhead space, something Edwards exploited. Not to mention the press, somebody piped up. The prison service has come in for a hammering since it happened." Ryan lifted a shoulder. "They were unlucky. That prison houses hundreds of dangerous men under one roof for years at a time. Only one of them had the means and the sheer bloody audacity to organize a helicopter pickup. He always was an arrogant bastard, Philip spat. The helicopter was piloted by this man, Ryan continued, pointing to a headshot photograph of an average-looking, middle-aged man in dress uniform. This is Andy Hayworth, chief pilot at the SAR base in Humberside. He has over 15 years' experience behind him in private employment and the Royal Air Force. Ryan paused to check he had their undivided attention, then continued. Hayworth has an exemplary track record and a string of commendations, so the first thing our colleagues in Durham have done is ascertain what led a man of his standing to forget his principles and help the hacker to escape. He picked up a marker pen and drew a line from Hayworth's photograph to one of a woman holding a blonde-haired toddler with a gummy smile. His wife and child are the reason why, Ryan explained, circling their photograph with a swirl of red pen. We tracked the helicopter to open farmland approximately 4 miles northeast of Mackenzie's home, not far from here in Pontoland. The helicopter was intact, but its pilot was found unconscious with severe lacerations to his face and head, alongside the beginnings of hypothermia after being stripped of his clothing and left out in the elements. Hayworth was taken by ambulance to the Royal Victoria Infirmary, where he was treated for exposure under police guard. When he regained consciousness, he was able to tell us that he had returned home from work on the same day to find his wife and child missing. A note had been left giving detailed instructions about what he should do to avoid either of them being killed. The time constraints and gravity of the situation led him, under severe duress, to carry out the instructions in that note. Hayworth proceeded to commandeer the helicopter without proper authority from his airbase and flew northward without radio support. Ryan shook his head, remembering the conditions that night. Let me remind you that last Monday night we saw 4 inches of rainfall, winds of up to 30 miles per hour, and he was flying low across the North Sea. Phillips cleared his throat and looked down at the stack of paperwork resting on his knee.